Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This episode of the new screensavers is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/NSS. And by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date. With engaging and informative video tutorials, for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/NSS and use the code NSS30.
A visit from the son of Spock, the most beautiful TVs in the world, and a drone that teaches you robotics. Live from the Twit Brick House in beautiful downtown Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
It's episode 9, recorded June 27th, 2015. I'm Father Robert Ballasher, and I'm joined by Father Robert Heron from HeronFidelity.com.
Heck yeah.
Heck yeah, heck yeah. Field promotion, folks. That's right, this is Field the promotion. Robert Squared episode.
I like that. Robert, yeah. Robert.
Robert. It's got a certain symmetry to it.
It's beautiful.
I love it.
It's beautiful.
We've got an absolutely packed show for you today. Leo is going to be talking to the son of Spock about his upcoming film, For the Love of Spock. We've got Martin Sargent making a bowl out of a potato chip bag. We're going to be teaching you a little bit about drones. We've got Kevin Rose coming back on to give us a tip about his screensaver app. It's going to be a long episode.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
It really does.
Robert, I got to say, I am just tickled pink to be co-hosting the show with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to hang out with yet another Robert.
I guess. Well, I mean,
it's a great name.
The world needs more Roberts.
It really does. And you know what? For just the technology and the ability just to hang out with someone who's really into it, like everyone around here, it's going to be a fun hour.
Well, that's what Twit TV is all about. It's the wonderland for geeks. I do have to say, DLTV. I know this was several generations ago. This was your past life.
That long ago, but it seems that way. A lot has happened since. So.
It meant so much to me. That was the very first time I realized that I actually had to do something about the colors coming out of my computer. Before, I just trusted the monitor. After your shorts, after those episodes, I'm like, oh, okay, well, there's a lot more to the world of high performance.
That was with PC Magazine, and that gave us the opportunity to not only set up a brand new test lab for the publication, but a lot of the testing and work we did in terms of display systems applied right to what we were doing on DLTV, and it was good for not only the content generation, but just the learning environment, and to be able to teach everyone about everything related to display systems, how to make them look good, and home theater in general. And that really kind of carried me forward into what I do today. So
yeah, and you've really made a name for yourself in that. That is what you're known for. That is the thing of which you are the guru of.
Genesis.
Could we get this? Could we do a segment later on in the show where we deep dive just a tiny bit into some of the more interesting aspects of, oh, I don't know, say high definition televisions and color reproduction?
This has been a good week, and as far as new technology being launched and new services that a lot of people will have access to eventually, and it's good timing to say the least. So yes indeed.
Well, before we do that, why don't we cover a little bit of this thing that we call the news? There's a big story out that's not getting a whole lot of press. I wanted your take on this. The European Human Court of Rights has come out about, well, comments, about trolls, about the freedom of speech versus the freedom to not be pestered. Now, this was a case that was retried about comments that show up on websites. Specifically, they wanted to know if they could hold the website owners responsible for the comments that show up on stories or in forums. Now, for us in the United States, this is silly, right? I mean,
it would seem so. I mean, is this now the law where it's like, well, you're now responsible for the content provided by the people that use your site? That seems difficult to police, or you're going to have to change up your system in the sense of making people register, being able to track who it is that makes these comments in a more way. It will definitely eliminate things like freedom of speech and the ability to be anonymous in terms of making those comments. Maybe that's what they're trying to steer people away from, but if you think about some of the sites online currently that allow you to post anonymously in terms of comment forums and things like that specifically, there are a few very popular ones out there. This goes directly against that.
Right.
And it's going to be interesting to see how it changes up in terms of if any of that will creep its way across the waters to our country.
Well, I mean, we deal with the same problems. If you're an online personality, you understand what it's like to get attacked by trolls, by people who are upset with something that maybe you've done and you've slighted them somehow. And they will spend an inordinate amount of time trying to get you to read what they want you to read. And yeah. I know you're actually pretty good about just muting, blocking, ignoring.
It seems like it's par for the course nowadays. And it becomes more about, will the service provide the tools I need to manage that kind of reaction? And I'd rather have that, yet still leave it open. I believe that everyone should have the right to say whatever the heck they want, even if it's relatively offensive or majorly offensive. I'd rather have the right to hear it. And to see it, and then to not, and to have that restricted by anyone on either side, really. And at the same point, that person who wrote that or made that comment should be willing to then take a response from me in the same line, for me to be as honest as I can be in terms of that response. And that's part of that basic freedom I've really come to cherish. And I'd hate to see that go away. So hopefully it's, I don't know, I understand why you would want to be able to monitor and restrict people who are just being vicious and malicious and things like that, and to say like, oh, we need to know who made this comment. There's that level of it, but at the same point, that beauty of freedom of speech is something I do cherish highly, yeah. And I never want to see that go away.
And that's our de facto response. I mean, we understand that. That's what you get with free speech. You're going to get unpopular speech you don't want to hear. But I think what makes this decision really, I'm going to say dangerous. I don't want to say dangerous, but it is kind of dangerous. Is they're saying even if a site goes through a best practices effort to get rid of those trolls, get rid of those harmful, hurtful, hateful comments, they can still be held responsible. You know, here in the United States, we have things for safe harbor, for copyright, and we kind of extend the same courtesy for freedom of speech, which is as long as you're doing something to try to cut down on the hurtful speech, as long as you respond quickly, they're not going to hold you responsible. What the European Human Court of Rights is saying, or something like that, is that no, even if you do that, you're still responsible if they manage to get past your filters, past your automated response, past all the sign up that you were talking about. That, I think that's a bit too far. I mean, I know hate speech is a problem, but now you're actually damaging speech to protect speech.
Because if you're going to the point where you're actually trying to, you know, manage it in such a way, there, at some point, you could see this going to the court systems, hopefully, and maybe they'll fine-tune it a little bit more beyond what they've currently decided. But it's an interesting turn of events for people in other places besides here who now have to worry about basically keeping track of people that use their own services. So
I'm hoping that this is just sort of a knee-jerk reaction. This is the court crying uncle saying, we have no idea how to handle these issues. With all this anonymity on the internet that we don't really know how to deal with, this is sort of the big hammer that we'll drop, and hopefully, as you said, we'll refine it and make it into something that actually works.
Freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. Speaking of freedom of speech, there's also freedom of expression, which can express itself in how you get the content you watch. And this is actually an incredible story. Evidently, Netflix is soon going to overtake the major networks in 24-hour viewership. Now, that's a big thing for people who haven't been paying attention to the industry, but both of us, this makes sense, right?
No surprise whatsoever. How many of us, if you have a Netflix account, have not binge-watched at least some content that you're just a fan of, a new show or something you've seen before, and that ability to then start at the very beginning and watch all the way through and watch it back-to-back in terms of episodes? It's almost impossible to watch just one episode of any show you're really into, and if you have the whole season, like in this case, Netflix dumps the entire seasons in a bulk package that makes it so convenient just to go through and watch and listen to and enjoy. I don't see this being a big surprise to me. I love the amount of content they have. I love the ability to watch as much of it as I want, anytime I want, anywhere I want. And, you know, I see the networks being a little threatened by that. And the fact that it's commercial-free, and I've seen studies now that say that, hey, look, what if Netflix started adding commercials? Would you pay more for the service? Most people will say yes. Just to eliminate that, I hate to say waste of time, but advertisers do have their place. But when you're paying for a service to have that content just brought to you, it's nice to be able just to say, back to back, no interruptions, focus right on the creativity of the author or the content producer, and just enjoy.
Well, you get a better narrative that way. I actually binge-watched the entire season 2 of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. yesterday.
Nice.
And I've actually watched it before. If I was watching it along with the network TV schedule, I would have watched each episode maybe once, and then maybe again when the DVDs came out. I think I've watched every episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at least 3 times. And because it's actually enjoyable for me, and I can have it running in the background when I'm working, this just passes another milestone we hit last year. Do you remember the story came out from the LA Times about how for the first time there were more broadband customers than there were TV customers with Comcast? And they further went to say a lot of those TV customers are just doing it because Comcast made it cheaper to get broadband with TV rather than just broadband alone.
Exactly. I was accounting myself among those people. It's like, but I finally did drop the cable service and went with good internet service. Happened to be from Comcast. They were really, I have to say, my biggest complaint is the limited number of providers of internet for any given place you're living in most places in the United States. You don't have enough selection in terms of quality broadband providers that can give you the speeds to do things like HD streaming or nowadays 4K streaming. So I want a greater selection of that, but I can definitely see data to me is more important than video delivery any other way. So having that quality internet, it's a business thing, but it's also now my primary source of entertainment. So
do you count yourself as a cord cutter?
Oh, without a doubt. Been about a year now, and I haven't really looked back since.
Yeah.
I pay for all the content I love, including sports programming is getting better and better every year. Services like At Bat, if you're a baseball fan, I think you're going to see a lot of other sports franchises and types of sporting events mimic that type of service, being able to provide, you know, watch any team you want, anywhere you want, anytime you want, at your heart's content. I know NHL for hockey is taking a similar tack with their apps, but as soon as NFL drops the ball, so to speak, and goes that route with providing their content, that's going to be very popular within this country at least. And they might be already doing that with some of their own services on select platforms, but without a doubt, the commercial-free aspect, again, I hate to ramp on that, but that's my favorite thing of all, is just to save some free time and have the quality and the content the way I love it.
I think it's an inevitability at this point. It's going to happen that people would just realize, I don't have to pay for a package 99% of which I won't use. I'm just going to get the programming I like. I'm going to get Game of Thrones. I'm going to get Major League Baseball. I'm going to get football. And then I'm going to get Netflix that gives me my seasons maybe a couple of months late, but I'll still be able to binge watch them the way I want. It's, again, it's choice. How about that?
Without a doubt.
Without a doubt. Speaking of doubts, you know, we've got people who have doubts about their technology questions. So why don't we just jump in to some Help Me. We've got a question from Dave from Salem, Ohio. Dave, welcome to the new Screensavers.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my question. I appreciate it.
Now, you have a little bit of a problem with, I don't want to say backing up. I'm going to say digitally preserving your memories on VHS.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a new dad to a beautiful baby girl named Aurora. Aww. And for the last 10 months, I've been taking, you know, video nonstop. But I use one of these little guys right here.
Yeah, we've seen them.
And yeah, pretty popular. And I could save them on a computer, back them up easily and stuff. But back in the day, my mom and dad were carrying around this beast.
I'm surprised you still have it. That's amazing.
I've used that.
My dad saves everything. I had to go up in the attic, and he had it with the instruction mail and everything. He keeps everything and dates everything. So so I was able to find that. And I have my question is, how do I get, or what's the best method or the safest method or convenient method to get all these, like, home videos that we have on these guys onto digital media, because I'd like to preserve all the cool family, you know, get-togethers that we had and stuff that my mom and dad have recorded over the years. And I want to wait too much longer because I think it's going to get harder as it goes on, because I don't even have a VCR at the moment. So, you know,
you also
hopefully
have the possibility,
you guys could point me in the right direction.
Yeah, what Robert was saying was that unfortunately you've got the right instincts here. The longer you wait, the worse it's going to get. The picture will just degrade with VHS over time. In fact, it's amazing. I found a couple of old tapes from, just 15 years ago, and they were nearly unreadable. Everything was washed out. It looked like it had been run through a really low contrast filter. It was, the tracking was horrible. I had to manually adjust it every 5 or 6 seconds. So, yeah, if you're going to do it, especially for analog storage media like VHS, the sooner the better.
Now, Magnavox does make a set-top box that incorporates HDMI output for both VHS playback and DVD. So there are those type of combo devices where you could do it yourself, or just about any tuner card or other device. If you have a player, you can then capture that information and digitize it on a computer. But generally speaking, I'll always tell people to look for third parties to do this for you first. There are services that will let you just put everything in a box, send it right to them. They will back it up, archive it in a quality format, usually, and send you the digital files along with the original media right back to you. And even some Costcos used to do this as well. They may still, but check locally. There's always a camera shop. Or, in this case, there are some terrific online services that specialize in doing this professionally. And in the process, if there is problems with the content, they can clean it up a little bit, they can help enhance it, and help make it look better for looking at it on a big screen TV. Because it's relatively low-resolution content on VHS tape compared to what we deal with today in terms of even DVD or Blu-ray or HD cameras when as they record, let alone what you're doing with your iPhone in terms of just recording that. And, you know, the beauty of shooting on digital nowadays is that you can have that back up immediately into multiple places and preserve it for literally ever quite easily. So,
A shop is always going to have better equipment than you're going to be able to buy on your own, unless you're hoping to spend thousands and thousands of dollars on equipment that will clean up tape, that will digitize it properly, that will auto track. And I mean, VHS, it was 480 lines of resolution, right? And
yeah,
actually, technically lower
like
than
240
that.
In some cases.
It was actually pretty bad. I will say this, I've done this process before, and you're not going to be happy. Just so you know, it would be great to preserve these memories, but when you start looking at this content versus what you get over Netflix today, you're going to go, I don't remember it looking that bad.
Well, it's still about just backing it up and preserving what you have. So check out local services. Even somebody mentioned a Walmart or a Costco, like I just mentioned. Those services are usually very affordable. But there are also some terrific online services I've used as well, where basically you box up everything. They send you a prepaid box. You get that sent off, they digitize it, put it on discs for you, and then send it all back to you in a nice care package.
Dave, let me ask you this. How many tapes are we talking about here?
Just anything that I could find. So I have a couple dozen right now. It's not, I don't have like hundreds or anything, but just, I don't know what a normal family would have, but just like I said, my mom used to record like our football games that we'd play and just family things, and mostly it was like your family Christmas, stuff like that. So nothing too much.
Robert gave you the right way to do it. Let me give you the geeky way to do it. If you just want to run it in the background and just have it going, are you a Mac or a PC person?
I'm a Mac person.
You're a Mac person, okay. Because if you were PC, there's actually a really good solution. It's the Roxio Easy VHS to DVD 3 Plus. It's inexpensive. It's under $50. It includes the capture device, so you could just play from whatever device it is that you've got that could play back a VHS tape. And this will burn to DVD, so it's a nice one-stop shop. But since you're a Mac person, what I would suggest is it's the Elgato. It's a video capture device. This works very well on Mac. It will do much of the same thing, except this also has the option to upload to like a YouTube account, which is, you make it private. That's a really good way to archive your memories and maybe share them with your family. I will say this, the reason why I like Robert's solution is because you are going to physically have to sit there and tell it to capture, then play, and then let it play out and then stop. Otherwise, you're going to end up with all this empty space. It's not fun. It's not great.
One of the people in the chat room, Guy Smiley, recommended a service called Scan Cafe. That was one of the primary ones I've used before and recommended. And
thank you.
They are terrific. And so that's another good option. But also, too, I want to say the older DVHS decks that used to be out there, that would at least let you digitize it with FireWire output. And granted, that's doing it yourself, and you'd have to go find one of these players and things like that. But that's another option as well that might get you better quality. I just hate seeing that yellow cable, that composite video cable. If you can avoid that,
find the super VHS cable.
Or the SVHS. At least you get the chrominance separated a little bit and get a little more detail out of it. But yeah, that yellow cable is freaking evil. Let me tell you right now. Just, if you can avoid that with everything, It's the worst.
Yeah. If you're using that yellow cable, you probably don't care much about color correction. So
that is not
there you go.
A good way.
What about, does that seem doable? Which way do you think you're going to go? Are you going to do the time-consuming and yet the I did it way, or are you going to do it the right way?
I'll probably do it the right way. As much fun it was to be sit there and watch probably all my old clips of me opening up like a Nintendo or something, I'd probably like to just ship it off and get it done real nice. But you know what? Those prices weren't too bad. So I think, you know, if I just had a lazy afternoon or something, I might be able to purchase that and maybe do a couple of my own, see how that goes first, and then maybe ship off the boxes. At least I got some options, which is awesome.
Let me tell you what's going to happen. You're going to do like two or three tapes, and then you're going to go, no, I'm going to ship these out.
Oh.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
The prepaid box is so nice.
When that prepaid box arrives, you're just going to say, yeah, okay, let's do this. Dave, thank you very much. I hope we were able to help you, and thank you for participating in Help Me.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Do you have a question? If you do, next week, it's actually myself and Patrick Norton. Ooh. So, yeah, that's another big one. If you've got questions for us, here's where you can ask.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
Well, coming up next, we've got, this is awesome. We've got Leo talking to Adam Nimoy.
Oh, sweet.
The son of Spock, about his movie that he's trying to get supported for the love of Spock. We're also going to be learning robotics by building drones. I know nothing about drones.
I want an army of them. And I want them flying out of my chimney.
Actually, we have those. Yeah. Yeah. They're downstairs.
I want that to happen.
I'll bring it down later on. I'll show you the no-hole.
I need dozens.
We've got our own little drone army. But before we go there, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the first sponsor of this episode of the new Screensavers. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you develop your own apps? Because if you do, you're probably looking for a way to accept payments over those apps. Well, you could do it the old-fashioned way by, standing up your own server, making an agreement with a financial company, maybe even doing some pen testing on your site to make sure that your customer details don't leak out. You could do all that, or you could just get 10 lines of code from Braintree and be done with it. This episode is brought to you by Braintree, which is code for easy online payments. Now, if you are that mobile app developer looking for the best way to accept payments, you gotta check them out. We had a chance to talk with Juan Benitez, the CTO of Braintree, and here's what he said about working with the companies who use their checkout system.
We get to work with some really cool people. We get to support, you know, Uber, Hotel Tonight, Airbnb, Eventbrite, GitHub, Slack. I mean, these are some of the best innovators out there. And also some of them, like GitHub and Slack, providing the platforms of innovation, frankly. To have the opportunity to work with these folks and to try to delight them is a great challenge. It's a great opportunity. We learn a lot from our customers, and we just hope that we can return the value to them.
Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and almost magical. And now you can add a similar experience in your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And their continuous support plus fast payouts means that you're always prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth. Braintree is helping solve the problems of mobile card abandonment by offering a best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Check it out for yourself today, folks. You owe it to yourself if you're a developer. They give you a full-stack payment solution. Support for all payment types that your customers might want to use. You can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo cards, and more, all with a simple 10-line integration across all platforms. With superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts, if you're not using Braintree, you're working too hard. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/NSS. That's BraintreePayments.com/NSS. And we thank Braintree for their support of the new Screensavers. Let me ask you something.
Please.
Are you ever concerned about putting data in the cloud?
Some of it. I mean, you're handing your data over to a third party, and anytime you do that, there is some risk involved. It may be minor, and they should have your best interest in mind. And I do look at services like EFF's website, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They actually rate a lot of these services that I use in terms of how they would respond to requests from the government and other things like that. And so for my most personal items, I still use good encryption, and then I'll upload it to the cloud. And
yeah.
I, 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 That's the only way to really be certain of anything anymore.
Encryption is the key.
Do it yourself.
Encryption is absolutely the key. We've been telling people over and over again, encrypt, encrypt, encrypt. Everything that you put out there, assume at some point someone who you don't want to get it will get it. So if you're not encrypting, you're just advertising your data. Which is why we had a chance to speak with Roger Chang, and he's giving us an option for encrypting your data.
Hi, my name is Roger Chang, and I'm from the Daily Tech News Show at dailytechnewsshow.com. If you use a cloud backup service like CrashPlan or even something like Dropbox, you might want to think twice about putting important documents up on them before you encrypt them. Now, oftentimes you might think, well, these services offer encryption already. Why do I need to encrypt it? Well, if you want to be on the super safe side and someone that works at those companies, be a disgruntled employee or perhaps someone who has access that they shouldn't have, can poke around at things that you don't want them to see. So before you do anything, encrypt all that important data. Tax information, family photos. You know, I have ex-girlfriends that I keep encrypted just in case, so my wife doesn't find them, that I keep up on the server. And, you know, it's still there, but only I can access it, even with their encryption.
A service that I have used to great effect is Sucasa. It's free if you're going to do non-commercial use. And the nice thing about it is that it allows you to use it with Dropbox. So everyone already uses Dropbox. This creates a new folder inside the Dropbox. If you drop files into it, it automatically encrypts them before it sends them up into the cloud. So this is that best practices, making sure that it's encrypted before it leaves your computer. Oh, they've got paid tiered services. So if you want to work securely with encryption with other people, you can send keys back and forth. But if at the very least, get this because it's a free service and make sure that what you've got in the cloud is unreadable to anyone but you. Let's move away from encryption and talk about something that, I think I can say is near and dear to my heart, and that is the maker movement, specifically people who like to make drones. I'm speaking with Greg Friesmuth from SkyZone. And you're going to tell
Skyworks.
Skyworks Aerial Systems.
There you go.
It's Sky. Yeah. I just like Sky. And you've got a kit that here that you're trying to back.
Yep.
And it's trying to teach people how to do robotics, how to do electronics, how to do aerodynamics. Basically, just a lot of teaching in a single kit. Tell me about this.
All right. So this is Edu. And what we've created is basically a development platform for drones. We saw that a lot of the drone kits out there were very kind of high-level barrier to entry for people who are just looking to get into the hobby or looking to learn about the technology. So we created a very simple, compatible with a lot of other friendly technologies out there, unit that we really think makes it a lot easier to get into drones and creating new drone applications. There's a lot of people out there just flying GoPro cameras around, and taking pictures, but there's so much more with this technology you can do. So we've made a platform that you can stick sensors on. You can stick new ideas and build laser tag drones or build gas detecting drones or what have you. So whatever your ideas can come to, you know, that you can kind of build, it's very compatible with like Arduino, Littlebits. The Littlebits Cloud Bit can talk to it. It connects via Wi-Fi to your computer. There's a great ground control software we've built. It's actually connected to the cloud. As you guys were talking about earlier, it talks to the cloud through the Wi-Fi. You can pre-program it and have it do waypoints and missions and all that stuff. So it's very, very capable and priced pretty reasonably for somebody who's just looking to get into this market.
Let me ask you something. We do cover drones pretty extensively on the Twit TV network, especially in our Maker show. We've also done it in our Coding show and even in our Enterprise show. But there are still people who will look at something like this and say, it's a toy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the evidence is saying this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. But they look at it, and as you said, they see people flying around with cameras on them, thinking, oh, it's just something that you do take out, and it's an expensive toy that you can crash into the ground. You're trying to do something more with this. This is what I like about this project. With the sensors and with the programmability of the controller, you're trying to show people all the possibilities in building drones.
Yep, exactly. There's every time we talk to somebody new about drones, they say, oh, I have this really cool idea of how to use this at my work, or I was thinking about this the other day. What if somebody had a drone that did this? And we're like, that's a great idea. You know, why don't if you knew how to do it, you could do it sort of thing. Or if somebody who is a tech developer or somebody who has decent electronics ability can pick it up and build a drone that does that. We kind of want to enable that in them.
Take me through the kit. What could I get? Let's say I back the project at the highest level. What will I get, and what can I create with what I get?
So you get the plastic pieces. You get the main frame.
This is 3D printed.
Yeah, this is 3D printed. So that's our SLS 3D printed.
So you're not using ABS or PLA. This is a higher end material.
It's a nylon, actually.
Nice.
Very durable and very fine details. That's what
you've got.
Like
some sort of matte finish on this.
Is that? So this is a paint, basically. It's a Cerakote, actually, so it's a ceramic coating that gives it a little bit of protection on finish.
Right.
The production pieces are actually going to be plastic injection polycarbonate.
Okay.
So that's our goal for that, but these are the prototypes. It comes with a brain board that we call Lucy, which is compatible with Intel Edison, so you can actually just pop an Intel Edison to the top of this thing. And it has Arduino headers on it, so you can put your favorite Arduino shield into it. You know, you can talk to the Edison. It's a full, you know, Linux computer running on there. There's a second processor on there that runs all the flight control dynamics, so you don't actually have to worry about any of that. Very intelligent motor controllers built into the board. So there's one board for the entire drone. You put it in, you connect the motors, and you're good to go.
This is the same approach that 3D Robotics is using with their Solo. Mm-hmm. They've got two computers in there. One is just a flight controller, so it handles all the basic leveling and just keeping the craft in the air. And then they've got another computer that you can program. It's completely user programmable for you to be able to program in waypoints. Or if you wanted to interface with sensors that you've added into, it's actually got a payload bay. This is a very similar approach.
It is. It's very similar. We're significantly cheaper than a Solo. That's for sure. And so I think that's an advantage to us. We also, our big focus is on sort of the software behind it. We think that, you know, the melding of software and hardware is very important to the future of this technology. And the software we've built is really easy to use. It's built as this very beginner platform where I know basic JavaScript. I can pick that up and learn to program my drone. So there's lesson plans built into it. There's actually coding blocks. It will detect the sensors that you plug in. So you can just plug in a sensor. It'll pop up on your web interface. It's accessible through your phone. So you can actually change your code while you're out in the field on your phone, just connecting to the Wi-Fi hotspot it creates. So it's very, very easy to use. That was a big goal in us. We've made it a little bit smaller than a 3D or Solo too, so you can actually do it in a
this
classroom.
This is like a 250 class?
Yeah, it's a 250 size. They're very zippy, so you can actually do them for racing. That's actually the popular uses for these size. We've put a big fat battery on there, and it flies for about 10 minutes, so you get decent flight times. We give you rotor guards so that
If you're flying indoors, you're probably going to want to put those on.
And a big focus of us and a big passion is teaching sort of the next generation of people who are going to be doing this. So we've been having people donate classroom packs as part of our Kickstarter. And the classroom packs are going to schools, high schools, where people will, you know, kids will learn how to do this stuff. And so another piece of it is safety. So we've actually created very intelligent speed controllers. So if you actually put your finger in the rotors, they'll detect that and stop the rotor instantly. So which is it kind of adding a little bit of safety and intelligence. We also use a really lightweight, flimsy plastic, so they're not like the carbon fiber blades.
Well, you're designing this to teach people. And when people are learning the first time, they're going to make stupid mistakes, and that would be a stupid mistake.
Exactly. So
I noticed you've got so this expansion board on top here. These are all I2C expansion ports.
Yeah.
So I could really load this thing up with every kind of industry standard sensor I can think of.
Yep.
LiDAR cameras, height sensors, barometers.
Yep.
What's your ultimate end game for this? I mean, yeah, you're selling the kit right now, which, by the way, where can they find it?
It's on Kickstarter right now. There's a few days left in our Kickstarter campaign. We're looking to get people to jump in and join on it. So if you just search EEDU on Google, I believe it's the first result for our Kickstarter. So yeah.
It's Greg Friesmuth from Skyworks Aerial Systems. Thank you very much for coming on to the new Screensavers. I love drones, and I love to see the fact that you're trying to make it easy for people to get into the field.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Now, coming up next, we've got Leo speaking to Adam Nimoy about his upcoming film, For the Love of Spock. But before we get there, let's go ahead and listen to Kevin Rose tell us about his favorite screenshotter app.
Hey everyone, Kevin Rose here. My app of the day is Screenshotter. Screenshotter is for folks that like to capture their screenshots. If you're like me, you go in and you find cool stuff throughout the internet. Maybe it's a cool Instagram photo or you're on an eBay auction and you just hit that little button to capture a screenshot. Now, it throws those screenshots into your photos library. And the problem with that is that as you're taking normal photos, they get lost. They get all over the place and you can't refer back to those screenshots. So Screenshotter is a free app that goes in, you auth it to have access to your photo library, and then it can detect all the various screenshots that you've taken over the months and years and brings them right to the forefront so that you can store them in folders or share them out to friends. Check out Screenshotter, it's free.
Hey, welcome back to the new Screensavers. Leo Laporte here. Yes, I know I'm not here, but I'm here. And I had to come in for this because I'm really excited to be talking to Adam Nimoy. You may recognize the name. That's one thing that's great about Nimoy. Unique name. Leonard Nimoy's son, of course. And he's got a Kickstarter going on right now to raise money for a film about his dad called For the Love of Spock. Adam, welcome to the new Screensavers.
Thank you, Leo. Thanks for having me.
I can't believe it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek coming up. That's amazing.
Well, actually, we're into the 50th. Well, you know, because the original pilot was shot in November of 64.
Wow.
Which my father reminded me of when we were talking about this project, about the Spock documentary. He reminded me that just after Thanksgiving in 64, they began production on The Cage, the very first pilot of Star Trek. So we're kind of in that 50-year mark right
That's
now.
That's exciting. Incidentally, I should have said this right up front. Condolences. It must have been, I'm sure it's very hard to lose your dad, but also moving to see the outpouring everywhere of love for your father.
Yeah, it's a big adjustment for the family and to have lost our patriarch. But the outpouring from fans all over the world has actually been phenomenal and kind of a great comfort to me, at least. And I know other members of my family. And it's still coming. It's not just the accolades that we've seen in the social media and the traditional press, but people have been contacting me through email and texting me and calling me. And even just yesterday, I bumped into some people I hadn't seen in a couple months, and they were, you know, extending their condolences. So it's been a big wave of support of people who have felt the loss of Mr. Spock and my dad.
You probably were pretty young when the original Star Trek began. There's a picture of you on the bridge.
Yeah, that's me.
With the ears.
You got it. That's me with the ears. Exactly. That was that happened in July of 66. So wow. I was just short of my 10th birthday, and we're about 6 weeks away from the air date of the original series when that picture was taken.
So no one had any idea. In fact, what were you thinking? What was your dad thinking? What was the cast thinking? Is this going to be a hit?
Well, no, they were thinking about how to get through the production day. You know, they didn't really know what they had. I mean, I think they knew that it was a challenging show, that the show was dealing with social issues that were not being seen on TV. It was a sci-fi show, which was a little unusual. There had been other sci-fi before The Outer Limits and Lost in Space. But they knew it was different, it was special, and that it was going to be very challenging. And again, they were dealing with stuff that most shows were not dealing with. This is why Gene Roddenberry created a space show in the future, is that he could start to address some of the issues of the day that were happening that he could not get away with in a contemporary TV show.
Yeah, perfect for that, of course. Race issues, all sorts of issues in that. For the mid-60s, that was really some heavy-duty stuff. And yet Paramount had no idea what it had. They canceled the show after just a couple of seasons. Was your dad surprised at what happened later?
Yeah, we were all surprised, you know, of what happened in the 70s with the syndicated TV market and Star Trek on the air 5 nights a week and, you know, and
10 years later, 10 years later.
Yeah, even as long as 10 years later. You know, it started in the mid-70s, but and on the weekends they would have these marathon 24-hour back-to-back episodes. So it was a shock to me. I was in college. I had no idea what was going on. But then when I realized what was happening at 5 o'clock, you know, around the campus every day, no one was studying, no one was in the building, no one was in the dorms, everybody was in the TV rooms watching Star Trek.
Yeah, including me. We're about the same age. I think I remember watching it as a kid, but it wasn't, I think as a kid, you don't really appreciate what you're seeing until you're older at college age. And then you get what's going on here. And it was very exciting. And we fell in love with that show. And we fell in love with your dad. He was the conscience of the show in many ways.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to say that. I think Gene Roddenberry actually told Dad that he was the conscience in Star Trek because of a lot of the work that he had done, a lot of the social and political activism he had done even after the series was over. The fact that he wanted to save the whales was the message for Star Trek IV.
Mm-hmm. He wrote that one or directed it.
Well, he came up with the story idea. Yeah. He directed that one. But he definitely had that sensibility. So
it's wonderful. And did you stay close to your dad the whole time? Were you really aware of what was going on?
Well, yeah, I was really aware because I was kind of the demographic that they were playing to. I mean, I was a kid who collected comics and watched TV constantly.
Right, me too.
Yeah, like you. So, you know, what I'm talking about.
I totally do,
I was not that close to my dad because he was, you know, it was a lot of absenteeism. Working on Star Trek for 3 years and then being on Mission Impossible for another 2 seasons. So he was not really that involved with the family. He's often said that he majored in career in those days and minored in family. But the fact is that when he got out of that and started to slow down a little bit in the 70s and he had a little more time on his hands, I was a rebellious teenager at that point, and he and I did not get along, and we knocked heads. And there was kind of a lot of up and downs in our lives throughout those years. Which really only, and even I've been quite honest with people and telling them that for a number of years we were estranged from one another, in fact, not even communicating. But we, in the, you know, about 6 or 7 years ago, we were both in our own independent recovery programs and doing a lot of work on ourselves, a lot of step work on ourselves. And we were able to reconnect and let go of the wreckage of our past, as it were. And we had a really close and loving relationship the last 5 years of his life. And he's again said in interviews that that last chapter, that third act of his life, he minored in career and majored in family in a big way. He was very connected to myself, my sister, my stepbrother, Aaron, and my dad's grandchildren were all very close to him.
Don't you feel lucky that you had those years and that time? Did he know that you wanted to do this movie for the love of Spock?
Yeah, we had talked about this back in November because we had worked so well together on a documentary I had made with him in Boston about his early life in Boston, entitled Leonard Nimoy's Boston. It's him and I walking around and talking about his experiences growing up there and the job, the little odd jobs he had while he was there. And because it was such a great experience, I wanted to do it again. And I wanted to do it to commemorate this whole thing with Mr. Spock. So he and I worked on it right up until weeks just before he passed away.
Wow. We're showing the video from the Kickstarter campaign of you opening the Foot Locker with the memory. Did you collect that as a kid? What's the story there?
Yeah, that Foot Locker was given to me by my parents in 1970 for sleepaway camp, which I hated. And then when I brought it home, I figured I gotta put all my collectibles
there's
in something.
Tribbles in there.
Everything has been in there literally since 1970.
Wow.
My stuff has been in there. My mother kept trying to get me to get rid of it because I kept it at her house for,
of course,
you know,
she didn't throw
years.
Away your comics like the rest of us, huh?
I know. I was lucky. She did not go in there and throw anything away.
So this is going to be part of the rewards, the incentives for backers. It is not too late, but it's almost too late. You have till, I think, Wednesday of next week to get over right now to the Kickstarter campaign for The Love of Spock. If you go to Kickstarter and search for The Love of Spock, you'll find it. Adam Nimoy wants to produce this. He needs $600,000. And I asked you before we began if you could do it if you didn't raise this money, and you said no.
Well, I mean, I could do it, but I can't meet my deadlines and I have no money. I've been using my own resources to get to the point where we're at now. I did a number of interviews last week with Bill Shatner and George Takei and Walter Koenig. Yeah, but the producers and I, you know, we're digging into our own resources to make that happen. But we simply cannot do all the rest of the work we need to do, licensing these clips and the hours of editorial that we need to do and the source music and the score music and the sound editing and et cetera. Very expensive proposition to make a documentary film. I just don't have the resources. I need the fan base to please support me by going to that Kickstarter page today, not waiting until the end of the campaign Next week, but going today to pledge whatever you can, $5 up to $10,000.
I'm going to kick in $100 right now because I think this is, I really want to see this movie. You've already, there's Zachary Quinto who plays Spock in today's generation of the Star Trek movies, and he's already agreed to narrate it, which is fabulous.
He's going to narrate the film. Yes, that's absolutely. He's fantastic. Been also supporting me and tweeting for me and posting on Facebook about this project.
Wait a minute. I want
we
some...
have a lot of support, a lot of interesting interviews. People are going to see a lot about Leonard Nimoy they didn't know.
Oh, that's so great.
More interesting facts about Mr. Spock they didn't know. It's a film for the fans.
You actually really, especially the picture on the front of the Kickstarter, you look a lot like your dad. You really see the resemblance.
Thank you.
There. It's kind of a neat thing to see, and I love the continuity. You did some acting too, right?
No, sir.
No. Never acted?
Never, no.
Never, no way.
No way. I was in class as a part of my training. My dad and I talked about this. I was in acting class with Jeff Corey, who actually taught my dad. But I never wanted to get in front of the camera. It's always been a love of directing and knowing how to work with actors, which was why I was in that class, is how to talk to an actor, how to collaborate with an actor.
But no desire to get in front of the camera.
No, because it's a lot. I loved my anonymity. I mean, I saw what celebrity meant as a young boy.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't the lifestyle for me. My dad was always very patient with fans, but I had to share him with the fans at the dinner table at a restaurant or just at an outing as a kid. It's very, very difficult. And so I really appreciated these past 40, 50 years of anonymity. I mean, I'm stepping out a little bit now to promote the film and to promote the campaign to fund the film. Which I don't have. And I was in, you know, on camera with my dad in Boston, as you see from that picture there.
Yeah.
But other than that, acting was not my calling.
Thank you very much. I'm sure in the last few years, do you feel like your dad appreciated the attention that he got? I mean, in some ways, he became more beloved. I'll never forget seeing the original cast appear on the first movie. And getting chills when they stepped up onto the deck and you see them again. And I think in some ways all of them became more and more beloved over time.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fan base is what it's all about.
Yeah.
They're the ones who've really kept the whole ball rolling for 50 years. And that's why my dad was very good to the fans, I think. I mean, every time I saw him interacting with a fan, he was patient and accommodating. And that's why he did so many Star Trek conventions. It was his way of, you know, connecting with the fans on a personal level.
I'm sure it's wearing and tiring, not only for him, but the people around him. But
oh, yeah. I mean, this is why, you know, in the last years of his life, he had to turn down a number of offers to go to, I remember Germany and Australia, they wanted him.
Sure.
And he wanted to go. He loved to go, but he was just physically not capable of doing it.
He did that great video, though, the Bruno Mars song, which is so funny. How did that happen?
Well, Bruno Mars was signed to Atlantic Records by my stepbrother, my dad's stepson, Aaron Bashuk. So Aaron asked him if he was willing and interested to get involved, and he said sure, and it was kind of a favor to Aaron. But we love Bruno Mars. I mean, we love his music. Dad loved to participate in that thing. It's a very amusing video.
Oh, it's hysterical. And, he's kind of, he's the dude, in a way, from the Big Lebowski. He's in his bathroom.
Exactly.
And
He's channeling the dude. You got it.
It's so wonderful to see. And his sense of humor about himself, and it just made you love him more. It must have been kind of a thrill, too, when they made a special hidden live long and prosper emoji in the emoji set on the iPhone that people can get. That's kind of cool, too,
isn't
it?
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell everybody to go to Kickstarter, search for The Love of Spock. We'll put a link in our show notes as well. Or you just go to fortheloveofspock.com. You can find a link there. Kick in whatever you can. I mean, at least the price of a movie ticket, because they're close, but they're not there yet. And there's only a few more days to raise the $600,000 they'll need to make this movie happen. And we want this movie to happen. I want to see this. And there's some really nice incentives. I might get some ears. Maybe I'll kick in a little bit more and get some ears.
There they are.
Yeah. Look at that. Wouldn't you love that?
I love that.
Man.
Yeah.
And
more rewards are coming. I mean,
we're
to try to get people to stay interested in the campaign.
Yeah. Well, this has to happen. You've already got those interviews with Shatner. I mean, this just has to happen. So Everybody, for the love of Spock.com. And Adam, I thank you so much for sharing your memory. Look at that picture. Is that is that college? That is.
Yeah, my college years. But we're actually at Monticello, which is Thomas Jefferson's home. We were doing a tour of the D.C. area.
Oh, neat.
But that's right in the middle of my college years, you know, the long hair, hippie, rebellious.
Yeah, I look
period.
Like that, too.
Yeah.
At Love of Spock, if you want to follow the Twitter account, Adam Nimoy. Good luck. We're going to make that happen. Everybody has to go right now for the loveofspock.com. Kick in just a movie ticket because you want to see this movie. I want to see it, and we all need to pitch in to do that. Thank you so much, Adam, for spending some time with us on the new Screensavers.
Thank you so much, Leo. Thank you for having me.
See you soon. And I'll see you at the movie premiere.
I hope so, Leo. You're right. On the list, man.
knock on wood. Thanks, Adam.
Take care.
Adam Nimoy for theloveofspock.com, at Love of Spock, to follow him on Twitter. Come on. What is a movie today? 1350. Kick it in. Back to you guys.
That's mind-blowing. I mean, the first Trekkie. Really, the first Trekkie. And we got him here on the show.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Just awesome. Yeah. I you know what? I'm glad that Netflix streams all of the originals as far as Star Trek goes. It's just they look so much cleaner than I remember seeing them the first time. So
you know what? Because of Netflix, I've actually grown an appreciation for the first movie. I used to think it was even worse
a little campy
than 5. But it's a little campy, but it's kind of good. You know, it was more hard sci-fi than anything else.
Good times.
Yeah. Let me ask you something.
Please.
Have you ever had someone in your audience ask you about how they get into your field?
All the time. Yeah. Well, yeah. And if you can't be fortunate enough to work for media companies and things like that, there's a lot you can do just to learn online.
They ask, you know, well, how do I get into what you're doing? I want to do networking. I want to do telecom. And it's always, well, there's a lot of good resources online. There are some great books out there. But ultimately, you know, you kind of say you want to sign on with an entity, a company, a person
without a doubt,
who can take you through some of the finer points of what we do. And unfortunately, that's not an opportunity that a lot of people have, which is why we're very happy to have IT Pro TV as a sponsor for the new Screensavers. Now, IT Pro TV is, well, it's TWiT for IT people. Exactly. They're fans of TWiT. They came over here when they were starting their endeavor. They use the same TriCaster, the same cameras, more or less the same format that we use here at TWiT TV, but they just do IT. If you want to get into enterprise networking, if you want to get into telecom, if you want to understand how the world is connected, IT Pro TV is a place to go online where you could feel like you're an apprentice. IT Pro TV has hundreds of hours of content. Now, with 2 studios and 50 hours of new content being added each week, they've got shows that are streamed live and on demand, just like here on TWiT TV, which you can get on your Chromecast, your computer, or your mobile device. They've got brand new iPhone and Roku apps, now with the ability to resume playback between devices. That's important because they want you to learn at your pace. You can start your lesson on your iPhone, move to your Roku, maybe watch later on your laptop, and it remembers where you are. Oh, they've got a growing episode library with video courses on Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, and more, including A+, CCNA, Security Plus, MCSA, CISSP, Network Security, Linux, Windows, OS X, desktop support, servers, and more. They've also got a course I really like that's the new ethical hacker, hacking forensics, investigation, and cryptography. These are courses taught by Sean Phillips. Now, Sean is a security expert who consults with enterprise and with the military. He wrote the book, literally, on ethical hacking. Their new search function allows you to search all their courses and videos for specific topics and quick answers. So it's more of a reference. Even if you know the material, sometimes you're going to forget that key that you need. Well, just search through their site and you'll find the video that has the answer for you. They have also got a virtual machine sandbox lab environment. What that means is you don't have to buy millions of dollars of equipment to get up and running. You could just look at the interfaces. And the interfaces are what we see every day, IT professionals, day in, day out. You could find out how to configure them without buying one single switch. Even if you're already studying with a book or if you're enrolled in a certification or technical degree program, this is fantastic supplementary material. It lets you learn at your pace, when you need it, exactly as you need it. It's also got one low monthly price. They get daily updates, new features monthly, a no-hassle cancellation feature, so you don't have to worry about this being hung on your credit card each and every single week. They don't want you there unless you're learning, because that's what IT Pro TV is all about. Now, here's what we want you to do. We want you to check out itpro.tv/NSS and upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications recognized by employers around the world. Subscriptions are normally $57 per month or $570 for the entire year, but we've got a special offer because they love the TWIT Army. You're going to get a free 7-day trial when you sign up using our offer code NSS30. That's NSS30, which will allow you to check out their courses, their live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Peanuts if you're trying to get into IT. The weeks of Monday, June 29th and Monday, July 6th, IT Pro TV is bringing back Sean Phillips to record two new courses in their ethical hacking series. If you want to see how he does it, this is a great time to act. That's Kali Linux and Metasploit. If you've been interested in those topics, now is the time to get into IT Pro TV. Their live stream is available for free with a basic account, and you can watch live from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern every weekday. Visit itpro.tv/NSS. That's itpro.tv/NSS. And use the code NSS30 to try it free for 7 days and save 30%. We thank IT Pro TV for their support of the new screensavers. Oh, let me ask you this. We've been trying to tell people how they can learn their craft.
Okay.
We've been trying to tell people how they can learn with drones. But would you be ready to help someone who needs help?
Of course.
Now, we've got Judy from it's a question mark. So I guess you're from an anonymous location somewhere on the planet.
Fairfax, Virginia.
That is pretty much a question mark. Yes, yes. Judy, you've got a interesting question about voice controls.
Yeah, I have an old elderly mom, and she has trouble with the remote and watches a lot of TV. Little buttons, you know, drive her crazy. So I was wondering if there's some sort of remote control, even a device that can sit next to her that could be voice activated and would interact with her BIOS television and, you know, change the channels or pause or the volume. You know, if there was any sort of technology that can help an older person who has trouble with the TV remotes.
You know, Judy, this is interesting because Comcast, I know with their Xfinity service, they do actually offer a remote that you can buy with one of their DVRs that will talk to you. It's a talking remote, which is exactly what you're looking for. Unfortunately, Fios isn't there yet. Fios does, I checked thoroughly. I actually called up some of the representatives who help people with access problems, and they were saying it's something that they were thinking about, but they haven't quite made it. So you can't get anything native for Fios. They do have one option, and that is you can run the Fios app on something like an iPad, and it actually has to be an iPad, not an Android tablet, which would
give
you...
She's not going to work with an iPad either.
Okay.
It's going to be just as bad.
Yeah,
you know, you almost need something like an Amazon Echo that could sit next to her, and she can go TV on, TV off, channel 9.
That is a great idea, actually. I would like something like that. The things we're finding in terms of just strictly voice control would be going with like an app on maybe perhaps just a customized phone or an Android device of some kind or an iOS device. But then you would have to take responsibility for cleaning that up and making it very simplified and having just the one button to make the voice activation enable. That would then control it. And that might even be going too far. Another option I tell people quite a bit is to go with something like a Harmony remote that at least gives you a simplified touchscreen interface or a simplified button interface that's activity-based, where it's very clearly labeled watch TV, watch a movie, be it a DVD player, Blu-ray, whatever. Or if they have like an Apple TV connected, it would switch to that device as well, automatically changing inputs, changing to that device, powering things on and off automatically. And then if there are specific TV channels that this person watches, that your mom watches, you can also program those in directly and have those just have the icon of the station just appear right on the screen and be a very minimalistic interface. But at the same point, it's not 100% and it's not voice controlled, but it also incorporates an app as well for using a mobile device that, you know, that's something I think I would like to see Harmony actually jump on to make it a little more easier in terms of adding voice control to it. Also, some of the new TVs, too, if you happen to have one of the newer smart TVs out there, a lot of them are incorporating microphones built into the remotes themselves, where you can then introduce basically voice commands that can drive functionality. But again, is it simple enough? And that's really the challenge that you're facing right now. And I thoroughly sympathize with you. It's something that I'm dealing with my own family in terms of creating just how easy can I make it? I've even seen people take remote controls, the remote that it comes with whatever service you're currently using, literally put a paper, like a paper towel tube over it, cut out just the buttons that they need to function and stick with that, and then label each one with a big marker around it. And, you know, that's really low tech, but it's another option to, to keep them from hitting accidentally buttons they shouldn't be hitting, or to enable a menu that gets them lost. And it's a challenge I want to see more manufacturers address. This is something, That is exactly what has to be done sometimes. And it's not pretty, but you know what? If it helps and it works and it makes it more functional for the people you love, that's what you're looking for. And I really hope the manufacturers do step up for usage, not only for people getting older, but people with disabilities too. Maybe your voice is the only thing you have, and it would be great if these TVs were as smart as they are, just a little bit smarter in terms of being able to turn them on and off and to change channels or to go to inputs or services that they want to enjoy. Because there's so much great content out there, and it's a shame that it's not easier for people to access the way they want.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Judy, this is the best of the bad possibilities, just because unless it's native, like the Xfinity box, you're going to get the confusion. I mean, you could program it perfectly. You could get a Harmony. You could get one of the voice-activated third-party remotes that you find on eBay or Amazon, and it may work, but the minute that they unsync something, so it's not turning on the cable box and the TV at the same time, or they hit a button that puts the remote into the wrong mode, you're back to the beginning. And now it's even worse because those universal remotes are incredibly confusing unless you know exactly what you're doing. So you know, this is one of those cases where we don't have a really good solution for you. I mean, you want something that's simple, something that's easy, something that's voice activated. For Fios right now, it doesn't really exist.
I'll tell you though, I am looking at new TVs that do incorporate the microphone systems, and now that gives me encouragement to actually use these a little bit more to see what their true functionality is, and if it's even approaching what it is you're looking for, because then I could at least recommend them. But at this point, it's like one of those features I kind of ignore, the universal control functionality, because most people go to whatever service they're being provided with and use that remote instead. And there is some ways to program those remotes as well to help simplify things, but in terms of just strictly voice control, I'm not seeing it there yet. I was hoping maybe the Xbox One with its pass-through technology and the ability to do voice recognition, and maybe that could be used. But again, you're adding a game console into the mix, and it's like that's not for most people either.
Is your mother a big gamer? Does she do Call of Duty?
No, perhaps. Doesn't game at all. All she does is watch the television, really.
Well, you know, it's going to be strange, but I think the toilet paper roll solution is actually the best here. Get rid of all the buttons that she shouldn't touch. It should just be power, volume, channel, and just use that as the way to turn anything on and off so that she doesn't accidentally push a button that she shouldn't push. It sounds silly, but that works really well.
I guess we'll go low tech on this one.
Low tech is sometimes good tech.
Okay, well, as an old Star Trek fan, what is it? Live long and prosper.
You've just made my day, Judy. Thank you so very much.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Wow. I always want to suggest tech, but sometimes you just kind of need to ratchet it back.
And you've seen the advancements, too, with Google in terms of how they use machine learning in order to improve their voice recognition. It's down. It is ridiculously better than it was even a couple of years ago. So having a company like that be able to step in and provide that core functionality to work and recognize the command you're trying to say, make it just work, that's something I think it needs to happen. And it would benefit a lot of people. And because I'm not waiting for the content or the service providers to necessarily do that. Maybe a Netflix or somebody, but not necessarily your cable or satellite TV provider. That doesn't seem to be high on their priority list. Although they do provide apps for mobile devices, but again, that might be too complicated as well. It's a tricky thing. I'd like to have a firm answer for, but if anybody does know, do contact me. I would like to know.
Yes, please do. You know, the funny thing is, I actually went over to one of my cousin's houses 3 weeks ago. And he has an Xbox One, and it's a beautiful setup. And he was showing me everything could be voice activated, but I was at the house when his 78-year-old mother was trying to use the TV, and she was literally having a screaming match with the Xbox One. And I'm thinking, it's cool if you know what it is, but if you don't, it's just frustrating.
Oh, without
it's
a doubt.
It's really, really frustrating.
I will say the Harmonies have worked, the Harmony remote systems have worked fairly well within my own family, just for at least getting it to a few very specific buttons for specific activities that related to the use of the system. And those have helped a lot. And I personally like it because I can use my mobile device to, you know, turn on stuff before I even get out of bed and have everything going the way I like it before I even walk into the living room. So,
well, now, at the beginning of the show, you promised that we would take a step into your world. And specifically,
Oh, yes. You
want to talk about HDR because HDR, this is a great week for HDR.
High dynamic range. It's a good time. It's 4K TV in general, too, has one of the benefits of it beyond just simply more pixels is creating imagery that is enabling a couple of specific things. One, high dynamic range and expanded color.
Well, that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be talking about HDR. But before we do that,
it's so good.
Let's take a gander over to the other room and speak with Ian Thompson. He's got a tip for you if you're taking a laptop traveling.
Hi, I'm Ian Thompson, a reporter with the Register in San Francisco. Now, as you can gather from my accent, I do a certain amount of traveling cross-border. And if you're going to be doing that yourself, it's worth keeping a clean-skin laptop, one that you don't use for anything else, just for travel purposes. An awful lot of countries around the world allow border guards to actually take complete flashes of your hard drive. Now, you can encrypt that, but some governments have also introduced laws which means you have to give them encryption keys. So it's much simpler just to take a clean laptop with nothing on it. And then when you get to your destination, get to a Wi-Fi point or a LAN and just download the stuff that you need.
HDR, high dynamic range. It's something that people who take photos have gotten very used to. It gives you that almost unearthly looking photo where you get the really dark darks and the really bright whites.
Totally.
You take two frames, you combine them together, and you get something that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get. Well, it's not just for photos anymore. It's for video and for TVs.
Totally. For 2015, one of the big things you're going to hear about over and over for the premium TVs will be high dynamic range support. This will be part of the 4K standard. They're not going to make this for 1080p content, per se. They could. They're just not going to. They're moving forward with this on the 4K platforms first. High dynamic range being the luminance information, the brightness details, being able to show not only the darkest portions of the scene, the details within the scene, but also being able to show extremely bright peak detail, like things like sun glinting off of metal or sunlight striking someone's face. The overall effect is really something that looks far more natural. Your eye is capable of seeing a very good amount of dynamic range, but it's usually a range within the overall aspect of what the scene would be like. Especially when you're in a bright environment, you might not be able to perceive the darkest details when you're in a bright environment and vice versa. So that's one aspect. One of the best things right now is that content providers are finally stepping up. We have these TVs that support this function, but now we're actually getting to the point where we have people like Amazon who just this week launched first content that you'll be able to actually stream to the compatible display devices that provides imagery that is in this new format, this high dynamic range format. And just right off the bat, I was going back and forth between the old standard and the new standard with the same 4K content. And just within any given scene, it was some of the most, I hate to use the word dynamic, but it was the ability to have that the darkest details still well represented, yet at the same time, just some of the brightest information I've ever seen come off a screen before. It looked more window-like than I ever have seen it before. Or, at the same point, it was just more captivating to the eye. And for that, it is just fantastic. And there are a few standards related to this in terms of that have been proposed by various groups. They've finalized these standards finally. And for later this year, we'll have a Blu-ray standard that supports the current state of HDR in addition to an expanded color palette beyond the HD standard we currently are experiencing.
You know, I want to talk about those standards. I want to talk about what kind of tech actually makes this work. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about the content itself. Because
sure.
One of the things that I've seen, they were talking about this at CES, was filmmakers have to learn again how to make their films, how to set their scenes. Because previously, they were flattening their contrast options. You could only go so dark, and you could only go so bright. And it really changed the way that you set up scenes, because you didn't want to have anything that was too dark or blown out. Now that you've got HDR cameras and HDR TVs, you have far more options that look something like this. I look bad in HDR. I look really bad in HDR. But what will it do to filmmakers? What extra tools does it give them to make something?
Well, the folks who've adopted digital cinema and digital video production, those cameras, many of them, like your high-end RED cameras and things like that, and Sony's, some of their best cameras as well, they already can record in an extended dynamic range. And then to be able then to author that content required literally the reference monitors that the engineers and the film producers are looking at when they author the content. If they can't see the content in the best possible way, there's no way they're going to ever be able to deliver it to you in any kind of consistency or accuracy. The challenge really was, and still is that how do you deal with different displays of different characteristics and different capabilities? The best TVs this year are going to be capable of putting out two or three times as much light as previous generations of TVs for specific highlight details, those sunlit scenes that'll look more natural, things like that. But then you need to have a studio monitor or whatever you're grading this video on that can actually do that as well. Otherwise, you can't properly author it. So the authoring and the editing functions and the increase in data, the higher bits, the more video information, and along with the higher resolutions, are all playing into it as well. And I think that's where the streaming services really come into their own because, and there's some examples too, the top frame in those pictures actually shows expanded color palettes versus a standard HD color palette. And most people go, you know what, HDTV looks pretty good as it is, but when you can look at something in particular, that Ferrari.
Yeah, every once in a while, you'll see a picture where it really stands
out. Or turquoise in water. There's just certain colors that physically or mathematically cannot be integrated into the HD video we enjoy today, be it a Blu-ray disc, broadcast television, what have you. It's a rather limited function of the colors that we can perceive. HD video is about 36% of all of the color we can actually perceive in terms of what can be encoded. You move up to something called, in this case, this is demonstrating what they call DCI color that's used in commercial cinema as well as what you'll be able to display on some TVs this year. And the beauty of that is that it gets the color coverage, the size of the palette, so to speak, up to into the 50% range. And the Blu-ray standard I mentioned earlier that's coming out later this year, Ultra HD Blu-ray, will actually, and there's a gamut I'm talking about, but all the colors visible, or all the colors that we could physically perceive, and those triangles represent mathematically what some of the different standards are, the biggest being this new standard called Rec 2020, which is what the Blu-ray standard will physically support. So it's going for the biggest possible triangle. Will a TV actually be able to display all those colors? That remains to be seen. But and the other one that kind of meanders around is called Pointer's Gamut, which is really interesting if you want to look that up on Wikipedia. It's more about the difference between subtractive color or color that's reflected off of an object rather than using primaries of red, blue, and green to generate the color that you see. Little differences there.
What about this quantum dot technology that became all the rage at CES? It's been off-quoted, but I don't know if a lot of people actually understand what it is and how it works.
Semiconductor crystals, based upon their size, like this chart shows, and the smaller the crystal, the more the color will skew toward blue, and the larger the crystal, the more it'll skew toward red. The size of the crystal determines the color it will emit when it's stimulated by some sort of electrical or light energy. And in this case, here it is with I believe a blue backlight shining onto a green test tube of quantum dot material. And you can see the green right at the bottom of that tube where it's closest to the light source. And in this case, this was a company here in the Bay Area that I visited that works at creating the materials. Basically, they manufacture these crystalline materials and then they bend them out by size, and these are very tiny particles, and then to create these pure color formulas that they then combine into the various needs they have for it.
That must be an amazing little factory floor sorting out those
dots. You know, you really don't see a lot there. It's not until you get to the end product. But the beauty of quantum dots is that they can replace a very inexpensive diffuser that's in the layer of materials that an LCD is comprised of by swapping that out with something that has the quantum dot enhancement film, in that case, QDEF, and then switching the backlight system from white LEDs to blue LEDs. Well, you start with blue light, hitting a quantum dot material or impregnated material that does green and red. So red, blue, green mixed together gives you the white light. So you have a very controlled white light source now with really good saturation points. And there are also there's some psychological or physiological effects related to color purity. If you can do very pure saturated colors, even if they measure the same luminance, you will perceive the more pure color to be brighter anyway. So there's some of that going on as well. But the beauty is that manufacturers can simply swap out a diffuser layer, add in this quantum dot layer, use a very efficient blue LED instead of white LEDs, and you then produce a display that has just greater color range by nature. The other way they're doing it is with LEDs, LED upgrades. white LEDs that are used in just about every LCD panel made today are now being enhanced. They're starting again with the blue LED, but they're coating it with red and green phosphor materials that then emit and together create a more saturated, colorful white light that they then filter into the pixels that we see and everything like there. And there's an example, a side view of a common film type layer for quantum dots with the red and the green particles in there. And then the barrier films basically are protecting some of the chemistry, not the dots themselves, but it's kind of funky to call it a dot, but it is a crystalline structure. And they're fairly easy to make. Right now, they're stimulating these quantum dot materials with blue LEDs. There is no reason they can't stimulate them with electrons, like the old school TVs. Like
an electron gun.
They could be an emissive display technology of the future. I have not seen this yet, but it's entirely possible. Rather than OLED TVs that we're all drooling over today, where they're directly emissive in terms of their light output, you could have red, blue, and green specific quantum dot materials that are stimulated by electrons to be an emissive display technology. And that would help with the off-axis viewing problems we have with LCDs today. I'm kind of nerding out on that, but that's just something that it could happen in the next couple of years, and that could be something that goes beyond any display we currently have access to today. And it could be relatively cheap to do large, ultra-thin flat panels that literally could stick to the wall. And it's only going to get better, but
Let's brass tack it here for the folks at home, because they've sat through a lot of announcements of the next TV they're going to need, be it the 4K TV or the 3D TV or the TV with this and that, and et cetera, et cetera. Is this a technology that's actually going to want people to change their TVs? HDR, quantum dot technology. Are they going to see it in a showroom? And you're just absolutely certain that they're going to say, yes, that I need to have that. That's my next TV.
I think so, especially when you look at dynamic video or high dynamic range video, it is such a nice step up from what we currently experience today from all streaming sources. Also with an expanded color palette, just those brief photo demos that we were showing earlier, just having that extreme color saturation and to be able to show a greater range of color, we're with the current content we have and with current display technologies, we barely scratch the amount of color and the saturation of color we can perceive. So getting something that can do more realistic imagery, a greater range as far as luminance information, being able to show you something that literally on high dynamic range TVs, the best today, when there's like a bright lamp in a dark room, it is almost painful to look at the light coming off the screen. It's so bright. And yet at the same time, characters that are dimly lit within that same scene are still perfectly done. And it's like, that is so much better than it used to be, even for me, a week ago. So finally, I
won't actually have to go outside to see things.
However, everything I just described, it is with the most expensive TVs this year.
There you
go. So this will trickle down eventually. But for this year, for right now, the premium sets from the manufacturers are the ones that will support these kick-butt visual experiences.
Robert Herron from HerronFidelity.com. If you need to know this information, and you do, if you're going to buy your next TV with any sort of, real-world experience in mind, you got to go to HerronFidelity.com. That's the place, right? I mean, yes.
I've got a review of one of these quantum dot enhanced high dynamic range TVs going up this week. So
there you go.
It's beautiful.
We're going to be moving to the mailbag in just a bit. But before that, if you have ever opened up a chip bag from the top, you know, you're having friends over and you want to give them a nice little snack, well, then you're doing it wrong. Because we've got Martin Sargent, who's going to show you how to turn a chip bag into a party bowl.
Awesome. Hey, I'm Martin Sargent. If you're like me, you eat a lot of crap. And you're always having your friends over to play D&D or Settlers of Catan, video games, what have you. And you want to eat some snacks, but your friends are kind of gross and you don't want them reaching into your chip bag. So here's a little thing. I'm going to show you a tip where I'm going to turn this bag of chips into a nice little chip bowl. I'm going to start like this. I'm just going to bite the top, kind of create a little hole like that. And then I'm going to take my hole and I'm going to start to kind of do a spiral pattern around here like this. If you're expecting a Linux tip or something, you came to the wrong guy. And this, and boom. Let's finish it like that. Now we have a nice little ball for people to, but if you don't want to get your hands all orange like me, I eat my Doritos with chopsticks. They're delicious. Here's one more check. If you put cheddar cheese on these and throw them in the toaster oven, the Dorito becomes something higher than how it started. Try it. It's wonderful.
Did you ever get a chance to work with Martin in the old days?
Oh, yeah. And his late night TV show, too, which was
Unscrewed. I was a fan of that.
I love Marty.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have him back in just a bit, so we're going to get more Sergeant antics. Yeah, maybe he'll turn something else into a bulb.
I need more Martin.
Yeah, now is the time of the show where we reach out and we ask the folks to send us an email and maybe ask some of the pressing questions that they have as people in the tech world. It's time for the mailbag. Oh, mailbox thing.
It is a mailbox.
Really, right? That always surprises our guests. Like, you actually have a mailbox?
Attack of the mailbox.
These are the questions. These are they. This is what our people want to know. I'm going to give you one of these. So yeah, why don't you take that? Take
all
those
right.
two there.
Give me the pile.
I'm going to take this first one. This first one comes to us from Darnell. And he says, hello, I've been wondering about this for a while. Why do two drives that are supposed to be the same as far as storage space have different amounts of available space after they are formatted? For example, I have two flash drives from the same company bought at the same time. Both are 32 gigabyte drives, but the available space on one drive is 29.8 gigabytes and the other is 29.0 gigabytes. Why is that? Well, Darnell, this is actually a question that a lot of people have asked because they're worried about getting scammed, right? You never want to get less than what you paid for.
Totally.
Yeah.
I understand. It's a value proposition.
It absolutely is a value proposition. Now, in the old days, with hard drives, this used to be about the way that we count it, because a gigabyte or a megabyte isn't actually a power of zero. It's like 1024.
Or base 10
exactly.
Instead of base 2.
Exactly. But that's not what you're dealing with when you're dealing with flash drives. Flash drives are, well, they're interesting devices because they're never perfect. When you manufacture flash memory, you're always going to get bad sectors. That's just the way it works. So when you put that many transistors into that small of a package, you're just going to have to accept that some of them aren't going to work properly. Well, the way that flash drive manufacturers get around that is they always put excess capacity, or they're supposed to put
totally
excess capacity so that the bad transistors can shut themselves down. It's part of the garbage collection routine, and then it replaces them with sectors from the replacement area. Well, you get differing amounts based on how many bad sectors you're going to get, how many bad cells you're going to get in the flash memory, but also in how you format them. Different file systems will treat memory in different ways. Have you run into that at all?
Oh, totally. Because you have block sizes when you do a format, and different file formats end up using different block sizes in terms of what's the smallest, basically, amount of storage unit that you can have within a particular storage device. So say if you have the difference between a 4K block size versus a 1 megabyte block size, and you write a small file to it, you're going to end up basically with differences that way. But generally speaking, with flash drives, that's what I see the biggest difference right. being is with just repartitioning or reprovisioning of bad cells within the device itself. So even within that same brand of device, you could end up with slightly different sizes on both ends just for, simple defects within it, or if it's running out of space. It shouldn't do that, but, especially if they've over-provisioned enough extra space. But at the same point, that could be it. Now, if it's off by lots, where
you may have gotten scammed.
Maybe, or there could be other limitations related to the file. If you're using the wrong file format on a particular size drive, especially with large capacity drives, mm-hmm. you just have to make sure that you're using some file format that actually supports, say, multi-gig flash drives and things like that, rather than the smaller drives, which are less affected. Can't use fat on everything anymore.
So. Right. There is actually something else that could be happening. This is very rare, so don't go through your collection of USB flash drives and think that you've been scammed on all of them. But every once in a while, especially when you get an off-name brand or a super cheap brand off of something like Craigslist or eBay, there's the possibility that it actually just isn't that big of a capacity of a drive. The size of a flash drive isn't determined by how many memory cells it has on the board. It's actually determined in its configuration. So I could actually take a 512 megabyte drive, and I can write into the configuration that it's actually a 1 terabyte drive. And when you plug it in, it will read as a 1 terabyte drive, but it just won't ever give you anywhere near 1 terabyte. This does happen in some very off-brand, very unscrutable companies that are playing around with the numbers. The best way to avoid that is just make sure that you buy a branded flash drive. I mean, it's something that you're going to be putting your sensitive data on. You might as well make sure that it's done right.
There's some good companies out there, too. Yeah. I like the fact that there are major companies. Samsung stepped up. I always go to SanDisk. They have most of the patents for flash memory technologies. But Samsung and their multi-layer and multi-3D flash memory technologies as well, they've just flooded the market with affordable, like literally half the price in some cases of other brands. So it's just, you know, stick with brands that you know.
Big, fast, good brand. Let's do that. Let's go on to the second question.
Number two, Robert and Robert. Hey, I'm so glad to be able to write in and ask both of you this question. Since Mr. Heron, you are the media person, thank you, and Padre, you are the enterprise person. I have a 30 terabyte movie collection of uncompressed TS files, transport stream files. I am able to back up to a hard drive. I am able to back up to hard drives since they are still cheap and able to have a local backup, but I'm trying to put it in the cloud. But the economics seem too expensive to me now. Do you have any suggestions for sites or any other direction I should look into? Signed, Robert from Lima.
Do we have any suggestions? Yes, stop it.
30 terabytes.
30 terabytes.
For cloud storage, that would be a long upload.
That would be an incredibly long upload.
And it's impractical for that much data.
Yeah.
And
we were talking about this before the show, and it's just, if you're going to have that much data, it's going to cost an arm and a leg. I mean, unless you do something with Dropbox where you're kind of misusing one of their business accounts, you're going to be paying at least $300 a month, or you're going to get it on something like Amazon Glacier, which is still expensive, but also way too slow for you to really use it for anything else.
So there are services that have free upload, but then to pull it back is going to cost you a fortune anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So one, this assumes, too, if these are TS files, you should have owned the disks that these came from. So there's your first backup. Make sure you keep that off-site. 30 terabytes is a lot of movies. That's several hundred. Even if they're Blu-rays, that's if it's DVDs, it's probably several thousand. But anyway, I would go with a NAS product, a network-attached storage. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of great brands out there. Synology is probably my favorite for a variety of reasons. There's the DS15 15 Plus. Five drives you can buy easily.
Six terabyte drives
today. Stack that in there, and
that's stackable, by the way. So you could put two DS15 15 Pluses together. They'll stack together, and they'll look like one device. So you could easily get more than 30 terabytes of storage.
Without a doubt. Or if you just need more than five drive slots, they have other products, too, that I believe go up to 24 slots as well. So that is the way to go. One, it's redundancy. If one or two of those drives fail, you can configure it so that it will email you a warning, and it will say, hey, replace this drive, and you just swap it out for relatively affordable hard drives, which you're already dealing with anyway. Also, the performance, it uses Intel chipsets for the internal processing. Those things can push data quickly. So if you do need to back these up, you have things like USB 3 ports and just the transfer rates to make this more, it's not gonna take you a week to fill the thing up. So that's the other benefit there. And again, it's just having the redundancy. And for this kind of video streaming, especially when you're dealing with HD video, or you know, maybe one day 4K, you're dealing with bit rates sometimes in excess of 40 megabits per second. So that's something you really want to keep local anyway, just for the response time and for the ability to transfer that data to the display device in the most seamless, quick way possible. Granted, 40 megabits, a lot of people may have internet connections that can support that, but you know, that's taking up a chunk of your bandwidth, you're paying for that. That's that kind of video streaming is really best done locally. And again, and if you really want to protect this investment you've made, just duplicate everything you've done. You know, have two setups and just copy one to the other.
Exactly. Or, you know, get something like an IO safe. They've got it's the 1515, but in an armored case that can survive bullets and bombs and literally, we've actually shot at the thing. It can survive like a 3,700 degree fire for 30 minutes. It's essentially a Synology box inside of a case of armor. And that's something you can have on site, and it's a backup copy, but it will survive disaster. But it really, it depends on why you want to back it up. I mean, if you want to back it up so you can make it available while you're away from your primary location, that's one thing. If you're just looking for a backup because you don't want to lose it, then I think Robert is dead on. Put it on physical media somewhere.
Yeah, or you should have the original discs anyway, and go, like, I have a couple of giant tubs of storage containers of all the discs I own, and those go off into the storage facility offsite. And you know, I do have a backup of some of my favorite movies on my NAS device that gets streamed into a media player, and it's fun. It works great. It gives me that like I have a disc feeling with network performance. But at the same point, if I ever lost that whole drive, I could care less, because I could, granted, it's going to cost me some time, but I have the original content. So
there you go. All right, so I guess our advice there is don't do that.
Stick with NAS.
Stick with NAS.
I would say also try building one on your own, but maybe that's,
free
you know.
NAS?
Yeah.
Why not?
You could.
Watch Know How every Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. Nice. And you'll find out how to build a free NAS, probably in about 3 weeks.
Nice plug.
Yeah, there we go. All right, we've got one more.
Yep. Hello, Roberts. Robert is. I'm a fledgling podcaster. I'm on a tight budget, and I want to do video and audio. I know I can use Levelator to smooth out audio files, but without trying to re-input the audio into the video and try to resynchronize it, or to synchronize it, I can't seem to find a simple way to normalize the audio within a video. I'm also looking into simple ways to combine multiple audio sources into one output with fading capability. I love the new screensavers. By the way, my podcast is called Tell Me I'm Wrong. Signed, John in Austin. So
that's John TX. He's been a longtime member of the Twit Army. I checked out his podcast. Interesting stuff. You know, I like what he's trying to do. He's a budding podcaster. He wants to get into presentation. Here's what I would say. I know what you're doing. What you're doing is you're trying to save money, because the equipment can be expensive. The software can be expensive. I get that. But if you're starting off, you have to make at least a tiny bit of investment. And the investment I would suggest is, rather than messing around with something like Levelator, which will take badly recorded audio and make it almost listenable, get yourself a decent mic. That is the most important thing if you're going to do podcasting, because people won't listen to you if your audio is scratchy. And all Levelator will do is it will bring up your level, but it also brings up all the noise, which makes it horrible to, I mean, you've heard podcasts.
Crap in, crap out. You got to start with a good recording source or a hardware to get it right. And then that makes the job so much easier in the long run. I work a lot with Audacity, and they have their own built-in filters and tools to clean up audio, but I've never actually worked with audio that's already pre-recorded or within a video stream, and you need to, you know, do you separate it out first and then work on it and then try to bring it back in?
It takes a lot of time. I mean, what is your time worth? Because you're talking about a multi-step process that's just going to be sucking down your resources. You could spend just a little bit of cash, and you can start with a better audio stream. Now, these are two examples from my studio. I got these a while back. This is an Audio Technica. This is a 2500R USB. This is a $60 mic. This is not expensive, and it's got a USB interface, so you get a nice pure transfer into your laptop. This doesn't have the best pickup. It doesn't have the best noise rejection, but it does sound really, really good. It's got a nice, a very clear bottom. And it has, as all the Audio Technica USB mics have, it has this little monitor plug so that you can plug in a set of headphones so you can hear if you're clipping. And you can adjust your audio to make sure that you're recording at the right level. This is a very good starter's mic. So, you know, $60, $70, and you've got yourself something that would just plug in and go. If you have a bit more to spend, I would suggest you go with something like this. This is the Audio Technica 2020 USB Plus. It works much the same way as the 2500R. It's got a USB interface at the bottom, but the difference is this is a really good sounding condenser mic. I mean, this was my gold standard for the budget. Okay. Items was the 2020 XLR version. And like the other one, this has a little microphone port so you can listen to your levels as you're recording, and it's clean, it sounds good, and this actually does have good noise rejection. So if you're working in an echoey room or a noisy room, this will clear a lot of that out. And again, this is all just a really good way to get rid of the junk that would be included in your audio stream.
Those are cool mics. Yeah. I like that. I like the USB out, and I like having the monitor built right in, the monitor port at least. So.
Right, right.
Nice.
Now, if you wanted to go even higher than that, I know you mentioned that you wanted to use multiple sources. Don't do it software. You want to do something like this. This is a PV mixing board that I've had, I think, for like 6 years. It's one of the very first boards that I ever had. This will take in multiple XLR, and XLR are going to be the less expensive. There are XLR versions of this 2020, or you could get what we use in the Twit TV studio. That's a PR40, but that's expensive. I mean, that's a 2020 will run you under $100. A PR40 will run you between $300 and $400. This was a $50 board that I got off of eBay. It will allow you to mix multiple inputs very easily just using these mixers. You can also play with the EQ. And what this will give you is just a way to have multiple mics in your podcast studio without having to spend a whole lot of money. Again, Can you do it with what you have and free tools? Absolutely. But you're going to be spending money in your free time. And again, how much is your time worth?
Exactly. And having a mixer like that, too, is great for just making it even and taking multiple sources at the same time, including, say, you wanted to add in, like, PC sound or something like that, yes, as well as another source, not even a microphone per se, but it's just a great way to provide that selection of inputs that you need and have control over it. That's really what it's all about. Start with good mics or clean sources, mix them the way they should be, and then enjoy. Yeah. And get it into your software. So, and it saves you a lot of work in the long run. And like you said too, time's everything. And if you start with good content, or I should say good quality in terms of the recording up front, it's going to save you in the back end every time.
Yeah. So. And it's not like this is going to go to waste. You're going to be using this equipment for a long, long time. So you can save yourself a lot of pain and honestly, way more expense in the long run by making some decent purchases in the very short run. And all the solutions I suggested are going to run you less than $200, $150 for what will give you undoubtedly a much better podcast experience. And I think that's probably one of the biggest mistakes that new podcasters make. They just think that they can do it with the webcam they've got on their computer and their iPhone microphone. And audio is everything. Audio is king for a podcast because people will listen to it more than they watch it. If your video is kind of shaky, they can get past that. But if your audio is bad, people won't listen.
And give a listen to your content, too. The worst thing for me, the pet peeve I have, is if you're in just a flat-walled room and it's just echoey, and no matter what quality mic you have, that room is just trashing how it could sound. And just by making maybe a small change to the room itself, you can help improve the quality of the overall presentation. So Do it. And you know what? I just picked up a mixer like this recently for about $70-$80, brand new. So, and it had extra features. I'm not even using like effects and stuff as well, but
they're not expensive anymore.
These are super useful.
Yeah.
And it includes lots of options for connecting a variety of devices.
And this one has been beat to heck.
It's got a little mileage on it.
That slider is completely sideways.
It's a little bent, but you know what? It probably still works.
It does work. And it very rarely does it make that crackling noise that I love so much. Robert, I'm afraid we've used up all of our time. I'm starting to get signals from the directors. I think they're going to kick us off the set. Could you please tell the folks where they can find you? We already talked about Hair and Fidelity.
Yeah.
But where do they find your work on a daily basis?
Check my website first. Everything gets dumped there. I write for a lot of different people, including, and I do custom work for manufacturers and things like that as well. But also follow me on Twitter. That's probably the biggest thing I love to do, is just get feedback and answer questions and go over things like that at Robert Heron. Super simple. And without a doubt, that really is, for me, the best way to interact. Also, people also leave a lot of comments on the articles I write. So, and I do look through those as well and try to answer them all every time. So,
fantastic. Robert Heron, a pleasure. Absolute pleasure to work with you.
Thank you.
I hope to see you back a whole bunch of times because it's always fun to have you in the studio.
I would love to.
Yeah. And don't forget, folks, if you want to write a question for the mailbag, you can reach us at newscreensavers@twit.tv. Write us your questions. Maybe you'll end up on the show. I will be back here next week with Patrick Norton. We're going to be answering more of your questions, so be sure to send us your tech-based, maybe racing-based questions. Wait, what's the most difficult thing, Robert, that Patrick has ever had to answer? What field of questions? I think we should ask for those.
Child rearing.
Ask Patrick Norton about child rearing and the Baja 500,000, whatever.
I have pain in my future now.
We want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, to all of our producers. They work really, really hard. To Lisa and to Leo for trusting me with this seat while they are doing research on a new tech show. I think that's what we're calling it. Yes, it's research. But also, especially to our cameraman, to Alex Grumple. Al Grumple. He's the guy who stands right back there.
Roger, that's Gumple.
Oh, Gumple. I never get that right. And to RTD, I can't shout out to this man enough. Brian Burnett, could you tell the people? Thank you. Can you tell people where they can find you?
They can find me doing know-how with you on Thursdays. So check that out.
We do the show every Saturday at 3 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. Don't forget to drop into the live stream at live.twit.tv. You can find out what we do before, after, and during the show. And as long as you're watching live, jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, and that's been the New Screensaver.